Live across Victoria.
On ABC Listen.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Margaret Paul.
Well, what was the issue that made you engage in politics? Was it local? Maybe it was global. Today, students across Australia will take to the streets to protest against Pauline Hanson and One Nation. So why are they leaving school or university to go to a protest? Are you one of them? Or maybe you've gone to a protest in the past. And what does this say about the way young people are engaging with politics in 2026? I'm Margaret Paul, filling in for Mary Guerin for today and tomorrow on The Conversation Hour. Also today, something local. A community is rallying to save a beloved local institution. I'm talking about Don Bosco in Brunswick in Melbourne's north, a place where kids and their families can go for low-cost or free activities like trampolining and basketball. But it's under threat. The church is selling it. The community wants to keep it, though. They say it's more than just a place to jump on trampolines or pat a bunny. This, of course, is another form of political engagement. What I want to know from you is, do you have any tips? How do we protect our community spaces in this age of economic belt tightening? Maybe we're going to see another protest on the streets of Merribeck down Sydney Road. Is protest the way to go, or are there other ways of acting to save community spaces like this? And coming up a bit later, how safe do you feel in your neighbourhood? And this is all related. We're talking about community, we're talking about neighbourhood, we're talking about engagement. A new study shows that people who feel connected to their neighbourhoods also feel safer. So what makes you feel safe? And also, how connected do you feel? Can you call your neighbours if you need to report a crime, or maybe they've stopped a crime in your neighbourhood? But coming up, let's talk about young people and political protest.
This is The Conversation Hour with Margaret Paul.
Well, across Australia, students are getting ready to ditch their pens and paper for placards and banners, skipping class this afternoon for a national student protest against Pauline Hanson and One Nation. The party has been polling strongly across the country, but of course, people under the age of 18 can't vote. But they can protest. I want to know what you think. Have you ever been involved in a political protest? What do you make of young people ditching the pens and paper for placards and banners and taking to the streets today? What do you make of it all? Today's protest is being organised by the National Union of Students, and organiser Felix Hughes joins us now. Good morning, Felix. Thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Margaret.
Tell us, what was the issue that made you politically active when you first started becoming a politically engaged human in the world?
The first issue for me was climate change. It was around when Scott Morrison was Prime Minister and we saw strikes happening across the country, just like at the moment, where students were standing up and saying, the government doesn't care about our future. The government is denying that climate change is a thing. And I remember sitting in high school being like, this is insane. How do we have a federal government that doesn't care about our future, that doesn't care about climate change, and that isn't taking the action it needed?
So
I remember me and a whole range of classmates going to these protests just because of that one issue.
How old were you then, Felix?
I would have been 16, probably.
Right. So tell me why. The 16-year-olds obviously can't vote. There'll be some young people at the protest today who are under the age of 18 and can't vote, and that's kind of the point. Why do you think students should get involved in political protest if they're under 18 and they can't vote?
So the National Union of Students, the body that called this protest, represents university students. And when it was first called as a protest, it was called for tertiary students. But I wasn't really surprised when I saw high school students jumping on board, seeing it and saying, we're going to come as well, because we do share that future. High school students have the same future that we do. And when you look at what Pauline Hanson's saying, she's attacking education. She's attacking public education. Students have to attend public schools and yet somehow are expected not to have a voice in what those schools should look like. Students are going to have to grow up and face the inaction or action of climate change and yet shouldn't have a voice in what government should do. We saw yesterday there was a candidate or a former One Nation candidate in Western Australia compare being gay to having mental illness. Students and young people aren't okay with that. And every time that happens, we should go out and call it out.
Sorry, Felix, as you were.
I applaud anyone from whether it's high school or university will come out and protest that. And obviously it was meant for university students to start, but all young people should be passionate about these issues.
So why political protest as opposed to writing a letter to an MP, posting on social media, any other form of political engagement? Why mass protest? Why take it to the streets?
Well, one, to bring people together, to show that we are a movement and that we are actually a collective movement in this. But young people aren't divided. Young people are united. And I think Pauline Hanson and One Nation try to paint us as these separate groups. They're trying to paint students against international students at the moment. But we are a collective. And to bring everyone together and show we will work together on this. But the second part is, this isn't all we're doing. In Victoria, we have an election at the end of November. And every day between now and then, students are going to be talking to as many young people as we can. We're going to be knocking on doors. We're going to be at train stations handing out flyers saying, Pauline Hanson is not on your side. Pauline Hanson is not on the side of students. She's not on the side of young people. And while the protest is the start, it's certainly not the end.
Felix, I want to read you. We've got a text message here that says teachers are running this. It looks like schools and teachers need a massive overhaul. Yesterday we heard Barnaby Joyce say students have been told to hate this country. They've been advised by people. They're not there of their own volition. What do you make of people who say this is not students making their own minds up? They're being told to get out there by their teachers, their parents. What do you make of that?
I think that's pretty offensive. On the first part, which is Barnaby Joyce saying this is because we hate our country, quite the opposite. We love this country. And One Nation are the ones coming out and calling for a white Australia policy, calling for one multicultural race, essentially. What we're seeing with the calls for like a monoculture, that's not Australian. That's not democratic. That's not what we want. And if you want to talk about people that don't love our country, I don't think that's students. Students are coming out in protest because we want a better future, because we want a government and a democracy and a parliament that actually represents young people and doesn't engage in these racist bigotry attacks on minorities. And as for whether it's students or teachers running it, this protest was called for by the National Union of Students, which is a student union. It is the union representing university students in this country. It is a entirely 100% student-run organisation. It's actually just factually incorrect what he said.
We've got another text saying school students shouldn't wag schools. This is from Megan in Kew, who says school students shouldn't wag school to demonstrate against a political party. Leave it to tertiary students. Now, I know you said, Felix, that this was initially organised for university students, but high school students have gotten on board. What do you say to that? Would students rather be in the classroom? Should they be in the classroom?
Students would absolutely rather be in the classroom. It's just at this point, what other option is there for them? Students, I would much rather be in the classroom this afternoon, but the threat of One Nation on our public education, on universities, on university funding is absolutely threatening to every single student. And while, of course, we would rather not be protesting, what other option do we have when Pauline Hanson comes out there and tries and pit students against each other, against international students, against migrants with these racist political attacks? Students have a duty to stand up and fight that.
Jenny in Fitzroy says, hi, Margaret. In the early 1980s, the threat of nuclear war and apartheid in South Africa, that also generated protests. The text message just keeps refreshing because people are really keen to talk about this and we're so happy to hear from you. People who blame teachers are part of the problem. I'm a parent and I told my kids to go ditch school and go to the protest. Change never comes without making people feel uncomfortable. Is that part of it, Felix, that you want people to feel uncomfortable because that's how change happens? Is that how it works?
I think Pauline Hanson is the one making people feel uncomfortable. Some of what she's said at the moment, where she's attacking international students, where she's trying to get classmates to turn on each other, I think is pretty disgusting and vile. And if you want to talk about people that are feeling uncomfortable, I don't think I'm particularly worried about Pauline Hanson feeling uncomfortable about these protests. I'm worried about the students and the young people that are being exposed to this vile rhetoric from a political leader.
Talk to me about what you'd like to achieve, because I've got a text here from someone who says, it reminds me of the early 70s when high school students marched in the Vietnam moratorium. And according to this text, they say they didn't achieve anything. Do you have goals that you want to achieve, you know, that you want to tick off by the end of the day? How does that work?
Yeah. So first, we're trying to communicate to as many young people as possible that One Nation is not on your side. One Nation is opposed to making tertiary education more affordable. They attack efforts to reduce student debt. They repeatedly attack universities and public education. One Nation is not on the side of young people. And we need to campaign as much as possible and speak to as many young people as possible to make sure they know when they go into the ballot box in November, young people are under attack by One Nation, and to grow that movement and to make sure as many people are aware as possible. Young people shouldn't just sit there complacently and allow One Nation to get into government. There is no greater risk to young people right now than a Liberal One Nation coalition.
Felix, I'm going to bring in Yvonne, who's called in on this topic. Yvonne, what did you want to say?
I just think that young man at speaking is super brilliant, and I just think that it is important for students to know what's going on in the world and try to assess for themselves what the best thing is for the community and for the country. And I, as a migrant in 1955, I went to school and I've been a secretary and I've done a whole lot of things, and then I got my own business and employed employees, which I love doing. And, you know, I think I did something for Australia and employed people. And I just think that it was great to have different nationalities working for me.
Thanks very much for your call, Yvonne. We've got Frank who joins us now from Warragul. Frank, what did you want to say?
Back in maybe 1973, the Americans were testing nuclear weapons off the Alaskan coast. And we were all very upset about this. I was living in Canada at the time. And my mother, bless her soul, pulled all six kids of us out of high school and junior high school and took us down to the protest in front of the U.S. consulate in Calgary. And interestingly, they stopped testing that a little while later. Not that we're saying that we caused that, but I just applaud these kids for having some principles. And, you know, it changed my whole attitude towards protesting.
Thank you very much for calling in. Really appreciate all the calls and texts we're getting. We're getting so many texts on 0437 774 774 and calls on 1300 222 774. You're listening to 774 ABC Melbourne and Victoria. I've got Felix, I have to tell you, I've got some people saying very articulate, clearly intelligent, but you're not getting 100% support on the text line. You've got some people who think you should get a job or be back in school.
I'm at university and I still am a university student. So,
how many people are you expecting across the country? Because it is a national protest today.
We are expecting thousands of students, which is, I don't think, a surprise to me at all. One of the things that we've been really clear about in this is one of the most surprising parts of the last few years has been the normalisation of the rise of the far right. I think we've seen sections of the media treating Pauline Hanson and these politics as mainstream political debate. And we want as many young people to go out as possible and show this is not normal. What we're being exposed to at the moment is not normal. This rhetoric on the White Australia policy is not normal. Calling members of the LGBTQ plus community as having a mental illness is not normal. And I think students have a role in getting out there as big as possible, in many numbers as possible, to show this is not okay. And the media that have normalised this need to be held accountable for that and actually reflect young people's views.
All right, we've got Kevin who joins us now from Sale. Kevin, what did you want to say?
Two things. One, Pauline Hanson's comments on gay people are repulsive. Two, I was a student in the 1960s and early 70s. We protested against the Vietnam War. It was not a failure. We achieved the end of the Vietnam War, for God's sake.
Yeah, I think I've highlighted that was something that was put in by the text message rather than my own opinion about how effective those protests can be. But it's kind of an open question, isn't it, on how effective protests in general can be, and how effective this one in particular might be across cities today. We've got another caller. Coralie's called in from Oakley. Coralie, what would you like to say? Coralie, are you there?
Yes.
What would you like to say?
Hasn't been brought up yet, but Mrs. Hanson has been known to say that we should send support army to help Mr. Trump with his war with Iran.
And you'd like to protest against that, it sounds like, Coralie? You're not...
Yes. Just as a statement, yes.
Yep, I think that's one of the issues that we'll see with this protest today is that there are, yes, as with any political protest, there'll be a lot of different issues that people are protesting against, and people will make their own minds up about those. There's a lot of text message coming in, absolutely fantastic. These amazing young people care enough to say what they're saying. Young people give me hope for the future, and young people have a right to have their say. I'm a supporter of young people. Again, we've got a few people texting in about marching in Vietnam, against the Vietnam War, and guess what? The war eventually ended. So, really interesting question about the efficacy of political protests and the role of protest, I guess, in people's political engagement more broadly. Felix, we'll leave it there with you. Thank you for your time with us this morning.
Thanks, Margaret. Appreciate it.
on 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Margaret Paul.
Well, what was that issue that first made you politically active? We've heard about the Vietnam War. We've heard about LGBTI issues and how those issues are discussed in our political life. What was that issue that made you get off the couch and attend a rally, write a letter to your MP, post on social media? And how are we engaging in politics today? And especially, how are young people involved in politics? How are they engaging? Kirsten Campbell joins us now. She is the longitudinal head of Growing Up in Australia. So she's been looking at thousands of Australian young people throughout their lives. Kirsten, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Can I ask by saying, and I guess we've kind of shown a bit about it this morning, but are young people apathetic? Because we hear a lot about that. What does your study suggest? Are young people apathetic about politics?
Thank you, Margaret. The answer is absolutely no. We recently published a report on civic engagement, and the key message was that while young people are often described as being disengaged, our results tell us something really different. They're paying attention, they care, they're really involved in social issues, but the way they participate in society to have their voice heard is changing.
Yeah, I think I read in your study that only 1% of young people regularly participates in a political party. And we've certainly heard that with membership of political parties. The more traditional political parties is not what it used to be. So where are young people putting their political energy these days?
Well, the protest we're seeing today completely fits with what we were told. So nearly one third of young Australians that we talked to reported that they regularly take place in protests. And importantly, this on-the-ground action is backed by really strong civic engagement through online and digital platforms.
And how significant is that protest as a form of participation? Because you've mentioned that turning up and rallying. How significant is that as a form of participation, particularly for young people who, as under 18, they're not able to vote yet? So why is protest so important?
I think one of the things that came really strongly through our report is that a lot of young people, whether they can vote or not, have real mistrust of traditional political channels or don't understand them. For them, political process is a way outside of those channels to have their voice heard and to take collective action with their peers to be able to give that sense of shaping the future in a way that will be heard.
I want to hear from you if you've been part of a protest. 0437 774 774 is the text line, or you can call 1-300-222-774. I've got some texts. The text line really is going off here today. We've got people saying, I support my 15-year-old son 100% and I'm very proud of him for organising students at his high school to be part of this protest today. Teachers had nothing to do with it. But then I've got Dave who wants me to read out some of the texts against this, please. And there are some people who are not in support of it. But I guess we're broadening it out to talk about not necessarily the issues that people are protesting against today, but how young people are engaging in their politics today. So, and we're talking to Kirsten Campbell, who's done a longitudinal study of growing up in Australia. So she's spoken to thousands of young people throughout their lives. So Kirsten, can you tell us, could political participation help counter isolation, or should we be a bit careful about making that claim?
Look, we know that political participation and civic engagement is a really critical element of social cohesion. It is how we have conversations about what our future would look like and how we get there. So we absolutely see that civic engagement has benefits for both society and for individual people. And we need to be really aware of how that's evolving over time and how Gen Z in particular is looking to engage in the political discourse.
And I guess you can contrast that to the idea, whether or not it rings true, of online activity being slacktivism. You've heard of that before, that
yes.
People can post something online and not necessarily be any more engaged than that, and just see where that goes. And that sounds to me as something, you know, the kind of image of that does seem a bit isolated. Are those kind of two activities, do they kind of go head to head in the kind of connectedness of being part of a live in-person rally versus posting something on your Facebook page or your Instagram page?
I think we really need to change the view that online activism is slacktivism. First of all, it's where young people are at. So nearly 40% of the people in our sample regularly engage with politics and social issues through social media, and 82% have signed a petition. And as digital natives, this reflects how they live, work and connect online. If you can deliver your job online, you can certainly participate in shaping your future.
What can schools do to support these young people in their political literacy? We've heard on the text line people warning that they don't want teachers to be telling people what to think. So what's the role of schools here? How do they support political literacy? Because, of course, that's really important. But without telling students what to think, I guess it's probably a difficult line for teachers.
Absolutely. I think one of the most striking findings from our recent report was that only 1 in 10 young people feel that they can have a meaningful say in government decisions, and about 40% say that politics is too complicated to understand. So there's a real role here for schools and broader institutions to demystify the political process, to create new channels that are easier to access, and to explain how, you know, contacting your local representative is a channel to have your voice heard.
For a young person who might be listening, and please feel free if you're a young person listening who might be attending the rally today, or maybe you've got your own thoughts on attending the rally that are different to that, for someone who cares about an issue but doesn't know where to begin, what are some constructive first steps that young people might like to explore, Kirsten?
We are so fortunate in Australia that we have the Australian Electoral Commission, and they exist to help people protect their democratic rights. They've got fantastic resources on how you use those formal channels to express your views to your representatives, to institutions, to Parliament, and they can support that. Similarly, local electoral offices exist to help you have your views. So walk on in, have a chat, and get them to help you express and share your opinions.
That's such an interesting point. I was going to ask you about what institutions can do better to support young people in getting politically active, because we've spoken about schools, but yeah, you've mentioned electoral offices and MPs have a role. There's a role for all sorts of institutions in better supporting young people. Is there more that our institutions can do to support that?
The findings from our report really suggested strongly that the issue wasn't whether young people are engaged. They are participating in a conversation and there's no one joining them. So there are definitely a big task for our institutions to demystify processes, to develop new engagement channels, to recognise where people are, and to give them that transparency and confidence that their voice will be heard.
I remember covering last year a city council in Melbourne's Outer North. Hume City Council had a youth mayor, and it was run by the Victorian Electoral Commission. They had an election that rolled out throughout schools across the municipality. And I did some interviews as part of that, and I was really struck by how engaged these young people were when talking about the issues that mattered to them, things like youth crime, things like feeling safe in their local shopping centres. They know, don't they? So how important is it that that they're taken seriously and that they're not dismissed?
As we said, civic participation, being able to shape your future, is key to social cohesion. It's key to individual well-being, but also these are the people who will be leading us in the future. And engaging them in how we tackle some of the big challenges that we have coming is really important. We know from talking to our young people, they are very aware. 83% expressed concern across economic or environmental issues. They're very engaged and they are looking for the opportunity to contribute.
Rick joins us. Rick's on the road. Rick, what did you want to say?
Yes. Look, I've been on protests, but one thing I did with the actual different demonstration things on this One Nation, I did screenshots and posted every capital city on my timeline for the students to see, friends and friends' family.
And Rick, you correct me if I'm wrong, but it doesn't sound to me like you're a young person in high school. Can I ask how old you are?
No, I'm 64 and my wife's 69. I'm on the road at the moment, but I've been involved in Daylesford, Talangada and Tanunga across the country. I remember in 1970, 72, 75, there was the Vietnam marches, but there were no nuclear marches in Melbourne from Flinders Street Station to Trade Hall. And they were huge, and it was to stop the bombing.
So why do you think young people have got a particular role to play here, Rick?
Look, we're custodians and our stewardship is a question. They're asking our stewardship of the future to be engaged with what is the correct side of humanity. And those that are on the other side of humanity will be brought to account, and we've seen it in the past.
Thanks very much for your call, Rick. I'll let you get back on the road there. We've got some great texts coming in. I took my daughter, who is 9 years old, along to the teacher's strike in Melbourne, as I feel it's important for her to understand that she has a voice to support things that are happening in her community. So lots of people talking about other issues that we've heard a bit about the Vietnam War today. Someone texting in saying, I'm 80. Students demonstrating makes my heart sing. 1967, 100 protesters outside the US consulate. So protests work, says Mike from Foster. Kirsten, what you found is that 9 out of 10 did report voting in the 2022 federal election. So voting is a part of political reality for many of these young people who you've spoken to, but only 1% regularly participated in a political party. What do the parties need to do to reach out if that's something that we're worried about?
Yes, and absolutely, they're strong voters, voting slightly above the national average. So it reinforces again that young people are engaged. But we did see that very low trust in politicians, political parties, and information from traditional media. So there is a real role here for politicians and political institutions to rebuild that trust, to be able to have a conversation with people around the issues that they care about, and to be able to show their fluency in those channels that younger Australians are using.
How do they do that though, Kirsten? That seems like a huge challenge for the parties.
It absolutely is. But I think you have referenced existing examples we've seen where people have been innovative about engagement, where they have held more participatory conversations, and where they've used online channels and platforms really effectively to communicate information in a trusted source, and then organise people around what they can do and empower young people to be part of the solution. This is what we hear. Young people want to be part of the solution, and joining them in that conversation and bringing them in is the way political parties can build that trust.
They want to be part of the solution. But are there issues that particularly young people are more passionate about? Are there issues that kind of bind them together, Kirsten?
Absolutely. And you will be unsurprised to learn that the highest issue we saw across all of our young people is concern about future housing, with 83% saying that they're very concerned about where they will live in future. They're also broadly interested in economic and environmental concerns. Many people were concerned about the future job market and what future jobs will look like, and then equally very concerned around what the future environmental change will mean, particularly in terms of natural disasters and events.
Thank you very much for your time, Kirsten. We'll leave it there with you. That's Kirsten. Kirsten Campbell, who's the head of a longitudinal study of Australian children. Thank you, Kirsten.
Thank you for having me.
I've got Jeff who joins us now. Jeff, what did you want to say?
Yeah, look, as far as I'm concerned, I reckon it's a very good idea for the kids to go out and do that. I know when I grew up and I was young, I had people who were older than me actually criticising me for my generation because we just didn't protest anything. Before my generation, yeah, they protested everything and everything. It's all sorts of things, but we didn't protest anything or whatever. So we were sort of viewed out as being a generation that just given up and didn't care or whatever. Well, I think it's a very, very good idea that students get out and whatever, because I tell you what, pupil-free days, that's a rort and a half. I don't know why people don't attack that. But if there's a problem with kids not being at school, there's a problem with teachers forcing kids not to be at school.
Were there any issues in particular when you were young, Jeff, that were particularly politically motivating for you?
When I was young, not so much, because I think when I grew up, I can't really recall. Problem is, when you're young, typically when you're young, you're really not interested in politics or whatever, and you really don't see how it has any sort of influence on yourself, and it's just an avenue to, if you want to argue with someone, talk about politics or religion. It's two favourite things to start arguing about. But,
Jeff, you're really going to set a cat amongst the pigeons by saying that, I think, today?
Yeah, and probably, look, the best thing I can find is actually if they're going to let people, young people, vote, please don't make it compulsory, because Australia's compulsory voting is so much of a joke. It does. There are no facts that support it. It's only supposition and opinion that support it. There are no facts. So do not make young people forced to vote.
Thank you very much for your call, Jeff. We haven't even spoken about lowering the voting age from 18, but, you know, that's a topic for another day. Sharon joins us. Sharon, what did you want to say?
Hello. Funny you mentioned the voting age, because that's what I wanted to say. I became politically active as a 9-year-old when I found out about the live animal export industry and have been fighting it ever since. And I think 16 is more than old enough to vote now. And I think it's their future. I'm too old now. It's not going to affect me what happens going forward and, you know, all the things that are coming at us environmentally, the way we as a species seem to want to kill each other rather than use our big brains to make solutions. We'd rather just be violent. So young people, it's going to be their world. Lower the age to 16 at least.
And Sharon, do you think it should be compulsory for people as young as 16?
I think it should be compulsory for all citizens. I disagree with Jeff. I think that where you have lower voting rates because it's not compulsory, I think you find those with a vested interest tend to run things, and we see that in the US.
Well, thank you very much for your call. I'm thrilled to hear we've had a lot of texts and a lot of calls on this issue. Coming up a bit later, how safe do you feel in your community, and is that related to how connected you feel? We've been talking about being engaged and connected this morning, but coming up on the Conversation Hour on ABC Melbourne and Victoria, how do we protect our community spaces?
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is the Conversation Hour.
You're with Margaret Paul.
Well, yesterday on the show, Mary spoke about a lack of spaces for young people. Well, there's a campaign to keep open a treasured community space that could be about to close. I want to hear from you if you've got a treasured community space. Maybe it's a library or a swimming pool. These places can be under threat in this era of economic belt tightening, but maybe you've been involved in saving them. We might need your advice. How do we protect community spaces? In Brunswick, in Melbourne's inner north, the treasured Don Bosco Centre has been around for generations as a place young people can go after school or on weekends and just jump on trampolines, play basketball, get help with their homework. But it's up for sale. The Salesian Order of the Catholic Church is selling it. We spoke about this issue on the Conversation Hour when it went up for sale a few weeks ago, and the issue went to Marybeck Council, the local council, last night. One of the parents who's been involved in the campaign to save Don Bosco and who actually spoke at the council meeting last night, Mark, he was at the meeting last night and he spoke. Mark joins us now. Hello, Mark. Thanks for coming along this morning.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So tell me, we've been talking about political engagement and you did a very political thing of speaking at a council meeting. What was that meeting like? Because I think what Marybeck Council experienced last night was that actually this community centre, Don Bosco on Sydney Road in Brunswick, everyone seems to have a connection. Was that evident at the meeting last night?
Yeah, absolutely. Amongst those who attended, but actually also amongst the councillors themselves, one of the councillors spoke up, his Oscar Yildiz, and Oscar and I don't know, I suspect we might not agree on a lot politically. And I think it was just so heartening to hear him speak about the role that Don Bosco played in his life. So he used to go there in the late 1970s. He'd walked down from, you know, deep Coburg with his mates, and he reckons about Don Bosco, he really doesn't know where he would have ended up. Like, it just played such a positive role in his life to have a space where he could go with his mates that was safe, that was keeping him out of trouble and off the streets.
Does it still do that for parents in Brunswick and across Marybeck now, Mark?
Yeah, absolutely. Don Bosco actually services a really wide variety, you know, of people across the community and children and young people. So, you know, people that live in Brunswick, Coburg, Fawkner. There's a petition that we're running at the moment that's got over 6,000 signatures over just a couple of weeks. And you can see, like, people have signed it from all over, you know, the area of Marybeck that the council covers. And just really caters to kids from all walks of life and all ages as well. So I used to go there with my toddlers from the age of two onwards. but it's also a safe hangout space for teenagers and often a real rite of passage in our community when your kid, your 11 or 12 year old, is old enough to go to Don Bosco by themselves. It's that first kind of taste of freedom. So yeah, it's got a lot of love, this place, and love across the generations, because there are people that used to go there as kids that now take their children there.
And I went out and covered this story for ABC News when it was when the church said that they were going to be selling it, and I did speak to a man who said his father went there as a child, he went there as a child, he got married through the church there. So it does really seem to be tightly connected to the people of that particular part of Brunswick, but also the broader part of Melbourne's north. This was brought up before Marybeck Council last night. What is the community asking for council to do? Because I think the church wants to sell the property. It's on Sydney Road, a big kind of triple fronted property on Sydney Road in Brunswick, really prime real estate. They're wanting $10 million. The community, as I understand it, is not asking the council to buy that property for $10 million, because councils may not have a spare $10 million just behind the back of the couch there. What do you want the council to do?
Yeah, so we were so heartened by the outcome last night, because we really felt like the majority of councillors really listened to what the community was asking for. So what we've asked for council to do is to really advocate as hard for Don Bosco as much as the community loves the place. So what they're going to do is they're going to write to the Salesians of Don Bosco and ask them to extend the expression of interest on the property. It closes in a week, so time is really of the essence. But also to reach out to state and federal government ministers and ask them to engage with the Salesians of Don Bosco and, you know, see what possibilities there are to maintain that youth centre and that family focus, whatever its future is. So really we're just, and council last night, majority of the councillors agreed to a motion to basically say, we as a council will fight alongside community to try and save this space and be really creative in reaching out and trying to find solutions.
That's a really interesting step from the council. I've got a really important question from someone who's called in to ask a question about why the church is selling it. I've got a statement from the Salesians of Don Bosco that I received when I was doing that reporting that says the Salesians of Don Bosco confirms their intentions to sell the Don Bosco Youth Centre and Hostel property on Sydney Road. They say the sale decision was not taken lightly. In fact, it comes after a thorough review of the site's current use and the services the Salesians seek to offer. Critically, it also considers the need to have sufficient funds to meet our obligations to survivors of historic abuse. So that's a really critical part of why they're looking to sell it, to meet the obligations to survivors of historic abuse. And we've heard a lot about that over the past few years. But I think what you're saying is you're not asking the Salesians not to sell it, just to put a pause on it and maybe extend that sale process. We've been talking about ways that people can get involved in these kinds of community campaigns, whether it be broader global political movements about climate change or maybe more local ones. Are you looking at other community campaigns that have worked in the past, Mark? What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, absolutely. We're definitely drawing inspiration from them. There was a community campaign to save the Abbotsford Convent, a more recent campaign to save CoHealth. And obviously CoHealth is a slightly different deal because I think federal and state, politicians feel they have a bit more skin in the game there. But ultimately, we are trying to think as creatively as we can, reaching out to, different organisations in the community that might be interested in the space. It's been amazing, actually, just the support and skills that parents and other community members have brought to this. We had an architect who presented an options paper that we included in our submission to council last night, who gave us some really excellent advice. We've had one parent help us out with T-shirt designs and helping us get them printed. It's been, just really inspiring what community will do to fight for something that matters to them, and not just to them, for future generations. Because, my kids are about to age out of Don Bosco, like many people in the group, but we want this to be you know, for our future generations to benefit from it, to build connections for their kids to, you know, get to play with other kids in an undercover space when, you know, lots of people don't have a backyard now. And we just really want to pay that forward to future generations. So it's actually been really inspiring. And I was saying to a mate last night, surprisingly moving, you know, being involved in this campaign. It's good for the heart.
Oh, absolutely. I've got a text here saying St Kilda PCYC was closed last year with the building to be sold. The community rallied to save it, and so the state and local governments put in some money and it will reopen on Saturday. People power. That's a text that we've got in. So we've spoken a bit about maybe the Don Bosco community could get in touch with the St Kilda PCYC community and have a bit of a chat about those saving those community spaces and how that goes. We've also got some texts that say Don Bosco relates directly to the conversation this morning about youth crime. Here is a place that gives young people something to do in the community. Hopefully it's something fun. And we need these services, some other text says. We need these services to support our youth and families. This will leave a gap in the area in the service. Can the council provide similar services elsewhere in the area? Mark, as I understand it, it is a really large block of land. Is one of the issues that's being explored that perhaps some of it could be, because, I mean, for people who don't know, Melbourne's inner north, apartments are going up very quickly in that kind of Brunswick area. So perhaps some of it could be sold off to create housing. But I guess what you're saying is perhaps some of it could be kept for the community. Is that how could that work? What are you looking at there?
Yeah, so one of the options we really like council to investigate with the state government is to be talking to Development Victoria about potentially developing the site, but making provision for a youth space that would then be leased out on the peppercorn rent. Even if a private developer gets their hands on the property, we'd really be encouraging council to look at, okay, maybe you can build it a little bit higher and in return, you know, make it a bit more profitable for developers and in return make provision for that youth space, which then, you know, stays in the community. Just going back to your earlier point about crime, I'm a recovering children's rights lawyer, so I've spent a bit of time inside youth justice facilities in Melbourne and also representing those young people as a lawyer. And probably stating the obvious here, but you know, kids who are involved, in crime at a young age, generally in the child protection system, generally come from disadvantage with massive childhood trauma. And I don't say that to minimise some of the dumb stuff that those kids do, but ultimately they're not kids that are coming from, you know, comfortable middle-class homes. So creating spaces in the community that are safe hangout spaces for those kids where youth workers can interact, it's just really critical because, like, I think we all know by now that locking kids up doesn't stop people from offending, but having inclusive spaces where kids can feel seen and safe is actually really what's going to make a difference. And yeah, I completely agree with the caller, with the person who wrote in and said, you know, if you want to do something about youth crime, it's actually through initiatives like this. It doesn't sound as tough, but it's way more important in the long term if we really want to prevent offending and give people opportunity in life and a second start.
Well, thank you very much for joining us, Mark. That's Mark, who's a parent at Don Bosco. And I hope you get a jump on the trampoline with your kids this weekend. Thank you, Mark.
Thanks so much.
And I've got a statement that I'll just quickly read out from the Merribeck City Council, attributable to the Mayor, Nat Abood, based on last night's decision. The council recognises the significant contribution of the Don Bosco Youth Centre that it's made to the community, and they understand the strong support for retaining the site as a free space for children, young people and families. They look forward to working collaboratively with the community, the state and federal governments, and the Salesians of Don Bosco to advocate for the best outcomes for the community at this site. So watch this space. I'm sure we'll follow up on whatever happens next. But coming up, how well do you know your neighbours? Do they make you feel safe? That's coming up on The Conversation Hour.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Margaret Paul.
Well, how well do you know your neighbours? Maybe your neighbours have helped protect your place from crime. How do you stay connected with your neighbours? Do you pop in for a cup of tea? Or maybe you bring the bins in when they're away, and that's an important part of preventing crime in the area. We're joined now by Nicole Peshek, who's the Manager at Administration and Members Services at Neighbourhood Watch. Nicole, good morning.
Good morning, Margaret.
Now, you've done a study looking at how connected people are to their neighbours and what that means for how safe they feel. What can you tell us?
Yes, that's right. So we put together a safety perception report that has looked at information and data from over 2,000 responses to see how people, how safe people feel in their community. And we know that when people are in contact with their neighbours, they feel a lot safer.
Why is that?
When they know their neighbours and they have a good connection, it's like another set of eyes looking out for them. So it's not just them on their own, but they have other people who are maybe aware of their circumstances. They don't need to be best friends and know all of their details, but they might know enough to know that they work a regular 9-to-5 job. And if they see something unusual happening at a time when they might be away, they might be on holidays or at work, and their neighbours are picking up on that, they know that there is another set of eyes looking out for them.
Absolutely. Call in if you can, 1-300-222-774, or you can text 0437-774. We want to know how well you know your neighbours, how connected you feel to your community, and whether that makes you feel safe. Nicole Peshek from Neighbourhood Watch, where are people feeling safest?
Well, people feel safe everywhere. So despite what the crime statistics tell us, we know that when they have a good connection with their neighbours, they feel safer. So from the data that we've gathered, we do ask them specifically that question. So we find that there's not necessarily a correlation between what the crime statistics are telling us and what our data is telling us.
That's so interesting, isn't it? So how can feeling connected to your neighbours, how can we foster that? Like, I want to get right into the nuts and bolts of that. If people don't know their neighbours, how can they connect? Is it a case of, in my street there's a WhatsApp group, and I tell you, every week it's full of people who say, who's got space in their green bin for me to put some extra stuff in? But it's also it's also keeping an eye on people, you know, do you want to park your car in my driveway? I'll be away for a week. Who wants to park their car there for this week? And it's kind of those kind of passive safety things. So how can people connect to their neighbours in a way that can increase their feelings of safety?
Well, a really great way to start is just to introduce yourself. So we know that particularly in newer estates, people might feel a little bit less safe, and that's because they don't know as many people. They don't have the connections that are really well established in older suburbs, such as in the eastern suburbs. So a great way to establish that is just to introduce yourself. It could be setting up a WhatsApp group or a messenger group for those people in your street, perhaps. It could also be setting up something as simple as a street library where you have a little cabinet with some books that people can share, maybe organising a street barbecue to get to know people, just little things like that that help you feel more connected to your community.
I know a lot of these newer neighbourhoods, I follow a lot of these groups on Facebook, and I know a lot of them necessarily aren't, you know, engaging in those walking groups and things that are in the more established suburbs, but there are a lot of Facebook groups. How important are they, or is it more about the kind of physical community garden, street library, walking group, those kinds of things?
Well, I think they can all play a part, but I do think you need to be really careful and just filter out the information and make sure that you're getting your information from the right source. So if you hear about a particular crime, you might be hearing it from 50 Facebook groups, and that's going to increase your fear in the community, whereas it might be a one-off situation. So just always be really mindful about that and be aware of where you can get more verified information. If you want to delve down into statistics, you can go to the Crime Stats Agency or join your local Neighbourhood Watch group, because they're really great at sharing the information and filtering out all the things that are either not true or really don't apply in your situation.
We hear a lot about CCTV and lighting and things like that as well, but I guess what you're saying is that the role of physical people and just talking to your neighbours is really important. But do you think those other things are important too, CCTV, lighting, you know, the way footpaths are constructed, all that kind of stuff?
Yes, absolutely. So your environment plays a really big part in helping to prevent crime. So having great lighting is important, making sure that you've got sufficient locks, you know, like on a garage door, maybe a door connecting between your garage and your home, obviously your front door, not leaving tools lying around that can be used to gain access, and just generally locking up, because that's sometimes something that's really easy to forget. You've been out to your car, you think, right, I'm going back out there in 5 minutes, and then you get distracted and you forget to go back and lock up, and most crime is opportunistic. So, you know, it's really easy to overlook that. The CCTV camera won't necessarily prevent crime. It'll record it, but it's important to layer that so that you've got a few different approaches.
And, Nicole, just before I let you go, do you have any personal examples of your neighbourhood being connected and what that does for feelings of safety or even perhaps reducing crime in a concrete form?
Yes, absolutely. I live in a townhouse and it's one of 18. We have a little messenger group set up and we're at the front, and my husband is, we call him Mr. Neighbourhood Watch. he keeps an eye out on anything unusual that's happening and reports back in the group. And that can be as simple as we see a strange person wandering around, or it might be there's a barbecue cover blowing down the driveway. Does this belong to anyone? So just keeping in contact with your neighbours and sharing those little tidbits can really do a lot about creating a sense of community.
Well, there you go. We can all stay in contact and keep an eye on when the bins need to go out and when the cars are in the driveway and all that kind of stuff as well. Nicole Peshek from Neighbourhood Watch, thank you very much for your time this morning.
It's a pleasure. Thanks, Margaret.
Bridget Duclos joins us now. Hello, Bridget's Margaret. On afternoons this afternoon. I bet you'd know your neighbours, wouldn't you?
I live in a bit of, like your guest, a townhouse sort of situation. There's four of them, and we do, yeah, keep a good look out for each other.
Is it a WhatsApp group or you chat on the
We just chat on the thing, and everyone does it. It's so good. One of my neighbours does my gardening just because she likes it. She's a doctor and she likes it.
I love that.
I know. It's wonderful. I don't know if it prevents crime. At least I've got a nice garden.
But do you bring the bins in and things like
yeah,
when people are
that.
Away?
We've shared stuff, yeah.
And so the question is, regardless of whether it actually impacts the crime rate, does it make you feel safer?
Yeah. Yep. Very.
How good?
No, it works. It works. It does. I'm a full believer in know your neighbours and, become not best friends, but become...
But keep an eye on each other.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Now, Margaret, I've got a question for you, and you're a young lady.
Oh, yeah, thank you. You can come back.
I want you to finish this sentence. You know you're getting old when...
Oh, when your knees hurt standing up.
I realised yesterday I said a couple of things to myself and I thought, oh, my God, you are getting old. So we're going to ask people that question. Everybody, doesn't matter how old you are, there's some little sign that happens where you go, oh, I'm getting older. Yes. So we're going to ask you that question. Also, a bit of a star-studded lineup. We've got Anthony LaPaglia in.
Oh, my goodness.
He's on opening night of Death of a Salesman.
Oh, wow, what a play.
Tonight, so that'll be fun. Also, actor-turned best-selling author Matt Noble is coming in, and he has got his new book, Maya. So I've got a good show for you, The Joy of Music, Music Trivia. It is all happening at 12:30.
Sounds like a jam-packed show. Thank you very much, Bridget.
Thank you.
Well, you get on with getting ready, and hope your bones don't creak getting out of that chair,
getting out of the studio.
Ow. Thank you very much. Hey, thanks everyone for joining me on The Conversation Hour today. I'll be back again tomorrow. You can listen again by finding The Conversation Hour on the ABC Listen app, and you can write to us if you have any suggestions of stories we should cover. You can write to conversationhour@abc.net.au. I'll be back with you tomorrow. Thank you very much and have a good afternoon.